You can actually investigate in your business when it is necessary. What some people do is they start to act as some unsanctioned police. You're monitoring everything that's happening in your business. All of a sudden, your employees are feeling like you don't trust them. You don't think that they are responsible enough. You don't think that they can do the job. You don't trust anybody. And if you build a culture of mistrust in your business, what you give is what you get. Your employees would end up not trusting you. After all, you don't trust anybody. But what controls do is that you only step in when there is a reason to question that something is going wrong. That's why these controls are very important. You don't question everything. If things are going according to plan, the spending is in line with the budget, your ratios are holding up, your metrics are holding up, your bank reconciliations are not flagging anything, there's no reason to be bothered, right? But if all these things start to flag something, then you have a reason to be concerned, and then you go dig. But guess what the good part is? When you react on the basis of your controls, it's likely that when there is a warning sign and you dig in, you will find something.
Every big thing starts small. It's a natural law. Every big multinational corporation was once a small business. Welcome to the Small Starter Business Podcast, a unique podcast for practical tips and advice to help you start, grow, or turn around your business.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Small Starter Business Podcast. I am your host, John Paul Iwoha. Today's episode is about controls. Essentially, the topic of this episode is about 11 intelligent ways, 11 creative ways to prevent theft and fraud in any business. Now, why is this topic important? Now, apart from the very obvious reason that nobody would want theft or, you know, fraud to happen in their business, there are actually deeper reasons for why you need to listen closely to this episode. The first is this whole fear of letting go. There are many entrepreneurs who are stuck in their businesses because they believe they have to be there every single day. In fact, any day they are not available to work in their business, nothing happens, right? They are afraid of letting go because they are afraid of things like fraud or errors or mistakes or even bad behavior. They are scared that any day they don't show up in the business, somebody is going to do something that will cost the business or infuriate a customer or make a mistake that will cost the business a lot of money. So there are a lot of entrepreneurs who think this way, and it's difficult for them to let go. As a result, they are stuck in their businesses. They wanted to build a business, but now they have a full-time job. Any day they don't show up in the business, nothing gets done. The second reason why this topic is quite important is that it can lead to stunted growth, right? When an entrepreneur insists on running the business by themselves rather than have a business that is structured as a system, what happens is that it's difficult to grow that kind of business. Without a system of checks and balances, it's very difficult to grow or scale any business. In fact, at best, the business may grow to just the personal capacity of the owner. And then because you can't keep your eyes on everything, because you can't be in two or three places at once, your business is limited to what you can physically handle, right? And then, of course, the third reason is that it's not sustainable. How long will you keep playing the almighty Lord, the boss, the leader, and the policeman or policewoman in your business? It's not sustainable. Your business can only grow so much. And it's only going to grow to the level where you can keep your eyes on everything. If you're that kind of person where you want to sign every check and then approve everything or see everything get done, it's going to be difficult for the business to grow. To start with, you're going to likely be in just one location, because if you're going to expand into other locations, other countries, you have to depend on people. Your business has to depend on systems and not just one person, even if that person is you, right? So it's not sustainable to keep playing the police in your business. So that's why this episode is very important, because we're going to be talking about that very interesting thing known as controls. And, you know, for the uninitiated, you might be asking, what exactly are controls? What is a control? Now, controls are intelligent processes. They are procedures and safeguards that protect your company, you know, when you're not around or even when you're around. In summary, controls protect your business from three kinds of bad things, right? Controls protect your business from bad people, who may have bad intentions to either steal from you or defraud your company. Controls protect you from bad actions. You may have good employees. You may have well-intended people in your company, but people can make mistakes, and that's what a bad action is. But if you have the right controls in place, it's going to limit, reduce, or even potentially avoid bad actions that could cost you money, cost you time, or even damage the reputation of your business. And then, of course, there are bad decisions. You can have good people in your business, you can have well-trained people, but one bad decision by somebody, including yourself, can actually cost your business a lot of money, cost it reputational damage, and cost you other sorts of valuable things. So if you ask me to summarize, controls, intelligent controls are part of a system in a business that protect you from bad people. These people may be thieves, they might be fraudsters, or people who have the intention of robbing you or damaging your business. Controls protect you from bad actions. Even good people make mistakes. They make errors, right? So good controls safeguard against bad actions, which could be mistakes. And they also safeguard against bad decisions. Good people also make bad decisions, including yourself. You can't know everything. But if you have the right controls in place, it's going to limit the potential impact of any bad decisions you ever make in your business. So without much ado, let's go right into the meat of today's episode. It's quite interesting. I need you to pay very close attention to everything I'm going to be saying here. So I'm going to share with you 11 practical examples of intelligent controls you can develop and introduce in your business that will significantly reduce the likelihood of fraud or theft or mistakes or errors and things like that could cost you money, time, or even reputational damage. So let's get started. The very first type of intelligent control is to reduce liquid cash in your business. Now, cash is always a temptation for any criminal, right? The moment people see cash, the temptation shows up, right? And all you need to create a criminal is the temptation, the opportunity to steal the money, and then it happens. But when you reduce liquid cash in your business, it somehow removes the temptation for anybody who wants to defraud you. It actually makes it more difficult, right? Because you're not dealing in cash anymore. Maybe you're using other means. You're paying with checks. You're receiving through people's cards, credit or debit cards, point of sale, bank wire, bank transfers, mobile money transfers, and things like that. Now, that's one way, reducing cash. But then to make it more practical, one other way is to replace petty cash with a reimbursement system. Now, if you've ever worked in any structured company before, you will find that there's this small thing called a petty cash. So sometimes it has a float of money. This is where people get money to buy small things in the business. Maybe you need to change a light bulb, or you need to buy something small, maybe $10, $20. You just walk into the cash room and then you can fill in a petty cash form and then they give you money. The problem is that the petty cash system can be abused by employees or even anybody in the business. So the amounts of money may be small, but they add up, right? So one other way you can get rid of the petty cash system is to substitute it with a reimbursement system. So rather than paying people to go and make an expense in the business, what you can do is people should use their money to buy, and then the company will reimburse them. So that way you have the extra opportunity to do your checks and balances before you actually reimburse somebody. If somebody took a cab to go and serve a customer, right, and then they paid for that cab and they're asking for a reimbursement, the question would be, did you have to go to that customer? Who asked you to go? Was the trip justified, right? So you see, when you are using a petty cash system, you are in the disadvantage because the money is already gone. But when it's a reimbursement, the person who is asking to be reimbursed, they've already spent the money. So they have to justify to you why you should reimburse them. And if it's not a reimbursable expense, then essentially you are discouraging people from actually going out there to spend their money, hoping that they can get a reimbursement from the company. Of course, like I mentioned, removing the cash removes the temptation. So encourage cashless transactions. Like I mentioned, point of sale, where you're asking people to pay with their credit or debit card. You can ask for bank wires. Either you're transferring to somebody, or then people are transferring to your bank account, or you can use checks, mobile money. There are all sorts of avenues you can use. But the message here is very simple. If you reduce the liquid cash in the business, you reduce the temptation. for anybody who might be trying to steal money, and you also reduce the chance that, you know, you're actually going to lose money in the business. Now, the second practical example is to introduce spending limits. Now, what spending limits are is you're introducing a hierarchy of spending limits. So, for example, if somebody needs to buy something, in many businesses, what happens is the owner of the business signs off on everything. You want to buy something for $10, the boss signs. You want to buy something for $100, the boss signs. You want to buy something for $1,000, the boss signs. $10,000, the boss signs, right? So what that means is any day you are not available in the business, nothing gets done because you're the only person who approves everything. So the moment you're not around, your employees have an excuse to say they cannot work because they wanted to buy something for $10 and you weren't available. Maybe you traveled or you were sick or something. And then because of that, things are falling through the cracks, right? Your customers are getting frustrated because things are not getting done. Your expenses are not being paid. So your suppliers are getting very weary and anxious and frustrated, right? So you don't want to put yourself in that kind of tight spot where you are watching all the expenses. One thing you can do is, for example, like I just said, you introduce a spending limit. If people need to buy something for $10, the team leader can sign off. That team leader could be a supervisor, but somebody who has responsibility when you're not around. So things for $10 and below, the supervisor can sign off. If somebody wants to buy something for $100, something up to $100, maybe the manager signs off, right? And then for you, for things to get to you, maybe they are like, you know, significant amounts, but this will be different for different kinds of businesses. For some businesses, $1,000 is a lot of money, right? For some other businesses, it is nothing. So it depends on what the materiality is in your business. By materiality, I mean, what is the amount of money that you wouldn't want people to be signing off when you're not around? It might be $1,000 for your business. It might be $100, or it might be $10,000 or even $100,000. Whatever that is, before things get to you, you need to have other layers below you where people can easily get things done. They don't have to come to you if they need to buy a pen or buy something that the business needs, or maybe the printer has run out of paper. They need to buy paper, and then they are coming to you, the boss, to sign off $10 to go buy paper. Somebody else should be able to handle that. And then what that means is that even if things are going wrong, they're not going to be large amounts of money. And that gives you enough time to catch on to what is going on. If there is any fraud happening at the $10 level or $100 level, you still have time to catch up, because before significant amounts can be stolen, you will be able to catch up based on some of the things, some of the other examples I'm going to share here. So spending limits help. And the other advantage is that they start to empower your people. Your supervisors, your team leaders, your managers start to feel like they have some real power, right? But even if they make mistakes, the $100 mistake is significantly less in terms of its impact and consequences compared to a $1,000 mistake or a $10,000 mistake. And then because you don't want a $100 mistake or a $10 mistake, you're trying to sign everything. It's not a good use of your time. It's not efficient as the leader of the business. So like I just mentioned, the higher the amounts are, the more likely it is that they will need higher approval. And another thing to keep in mind is the higher the amount of money somebody needs, the more the need for supporting documentation. They need to show up with receipts or something that proves that that money has to be spent or needs to be spent. And senior approvals need to come in. So I hope you get the gist. Spending limits can significantly free up your time and help to get things done even when you're not available in the company. It's not every day that they need to buy a $10,000 item or a $100,000 item, or if your business is small, a $1,000 item. Those things can wait. But sometimes something that costs $10, like you need to send out a proposal to a customer, to a client, and then the printer has run out of paper and you are not in the office to sign off $10 to go buy paper. That is a small problem that can lead to significant consequences. You could lose out on a contract. You could make a customer dissatisfied. It could damage your reputation when people find out that the reason why you did not deliver on time is that you didn't have paper in your printer. And the reason is because nobody else can buy stuff except you are around to sign off. You know, sometimes it doesn't leave a good taste in the mouth. Now, the third example of a practical control is approvals. Now, Why approvals are very important when you're trying to build a system in your company, in your business, because what approvals mean is that it would be unlikely that people would take unilateral action. And by unilateral action, I mean somebody just wakes up and decides to take an action. And that person, that's the only person in the company who knows about it. What an approval does is that somebody else has to know. You want to buy something, you want to buy raw materials, you need an approval. You need to move an important piece of machinery out of the company premises, you need an approval. So if people need an approval for serious stuff, what it means is that one person cannot cook up a plan and execute that plan without nobody else knowing. At the minimum, for fraud to happen, you may need at least two people, the person who is requesting and the person who is approving. So it is harder for two people to collude to defraud your company than one person. One person can easily do it. They don't need any other person to cooperate. They can easily pull it off. But the moment you need two people to commit a crime, or three people to commit a crime, or four people, it starts to get more and more complex, and the more sophisticated that thing has to know. So at the minimum, somebody else has to know, which is why approvals are very important. If you need to buy something considerable, you need to purchase or spend money that's considerable, somebody needs to approve it. If you need a reimbursement for money that you have spent, somebody needs to approve it. If you're going to give credit to a customer, you can't just make up your mind. Your salespeople can't just give credit to a customer. They need approvals for that, right? You can't just refund the customer. You need an approval from a senior authority. Somebody can't just come into the company premises and move an important piece of machinery, or the company car, or the computers at the office. They can't just leave the premises. They need to show an approval at the gate or something to say somebody else knows about this thing. It's not a unilateral action. So I hope you get the gist. The reason why approvals are important is because it's much harder for two people to commit a crime than it is for one person to commit a crime. When one person wants to commit a crime, it's very easy. They don't need any help from outside. They just go ahead and execute their plan. But if they need somebody else to approve of it, and a paper trail, you know, that starts to get more and more difficult. So that's it for the third one. The fourth example of a practical control I want to share is to segregate your key accounts. And I'm going to explain exactly what this means, right? So for many businesses, they just have maybe one or two bank accounts. And it doesn't matter if you have three or four or five bank accounts, right? What happens is all the money comes into that account. And when the business wants to spend money, they also spend from that same account. So they may have 10 different bank accounts, but the accounts are just the same. They receive money and they spend money. All those accounts receive money and they spend money. Now, by segregating your key accounts, what it means is that you need to separate your income accounts from your spending accounts. So let me explain. Every company sells stuff. You may be selling products or you may be selling services. When you want to receive payment from your customers, it should go to a certain account. That account mainly gets inflows in terms of sales. That account is for collecting payments from your customers. Even if you collect cash from your customers, you go pay it into that account. If you make any sales, you pay it into that account. So that's exactly what that account is for inflows, right? Then you have expense accounts, which are for your operating costs. If you need to pay your suppliers, you need to pay for electricity, you need to pay for internet, you need to pay your employees, salaries, right? Those things should come from expense accounts. Now, why is this important? This is important because a single account for everything, where there's money coming in and going out from a single account, it can be very confusing. And there is nothing that helps to facilitate fraud and theft more than confusion. When there is confusion, criminals can take that advantage, you know, because it favors them. So what you can do by separating your accounts is that when you receive most of your income in one account, you can then, based on a budget, and I'm going to explain, a budget is one of those controls I'm going to explain later on. If you know that your budget for the month is $30,000, and I mean, this is the amount of money you spend on raw materials, on salaries, on whatever, you take that money away from your income account, from your sales account, and put it in your operating expense account. So what this does for you is that you've only paid in $20,000 into your expense account. Whenever that money is maxed out, whenever that whole money is finished, that triggers for you, because if normally you spend $20,000 every month to run your business, all of a sudden that $20,000 is finished. The question is, why did it finish? Why did it finish before the end of the month? We normally spend $20,000 every month. Why is this month different? What is going on? You see what's happening. You're asking important questions. But if those accounts were not separated, you just keep drawing money from the account because there is money in the account. That's the lure of always drawing money from an account that always has money. So if you're always drawing money from an account where you're receiving your inflows and your sales, you might not get that red flag, that warning sound, that alarm when you are spending above the normal limit. So that's a good practice. You separate your income accounts from your spending accounts. Your spending account is your expense account or your operating account for running your business, all those costs that are involved. Okay, so that's it for segregating your key accounts. The fifth practical control I want to talk about is the practice of formal requests. The practice of formal requests. So what a formal request means is if somebody wants to, say, for example, wants to hire somebody in your company or somebody wants to spend money, do they just go ahead and spend that money because they're a supervisor or they're a manager or something? Do people just make up their minds and go do what they want, right? There has to be formal requests. And this is important to avoid he said, she said. You know, when something goes wrong, you get the, I thought you said I should. You know, when there are verbal conversations, there's no record, right? When people talk over the phone or they talk in person, there's no record. One person can easily deny that they said something or that they asked for something or that they actually withdrew a certain amount of money. People can deny. But when you make the request formal, usually a formal request is in written format. That's a preferable form. It could be an email saying, you know, dear sir, I wish to request for the sum of $1,500 to purchase XYZ. Now you have an email, you have a formal piece of documentation that you can reference in the future to say, you know, that $1,500 that was spent because you actually requested for it. You sent me an email on the 12th of July, you know, at this time. So there is a record. And that record will not be possible if I just said, okay, go ahead. I made a verbal request. Human beings can forget. Human beings can deny. Human beings can lie, you know. But that's why you need to have the formal records. It could be in the form of a form. Forms are a very common type for formal request. You want to request for money, you fill in the form. You want to order something from a supplier, you fill in the purchase order. All those forms are there to make life easy so that people are not always typing letters. They fill in what's the name, what's the amount, what's this for. Then you sign and then you send it to the person who is supposed to approve it and then the person signs. That creates a verification or an authentication, right? Because your signature is there, your name is there, the date is there, the amount of money is there, the reason for asking for the money is there. So you create there's a responsible party. We know who is asking for the money. We know who approved it. We know the reason for it. And there is an audit trail. So this covers everything from purchasing to expenses to sales, or if you're even going to hire somebody, right? All these things are important. There needs to be formal requests. It can be on the basis of, I called you on the phone and I asked you, and then you said, I should, you know, and then somebody said, he said, she said. To avoid all of that, everything should come through formal requests. It could be in an email, it could be in a form, it could be in a memo. If your company uses online tools like Slack or maybe WhatsApp for business, what you just need is a verifiable trail of documentation of requests to say, you formally requested for this and I approved. And there is a record to show that. You need that record of the formal request. Now, the sixth type of practical control I want to talk about is the principle of segregated responsibility. And this is very important and I need you to pay attention to it. So what this means is that at least two people must be involved in any important cycle, right? Like I mentioned before, it's easier to steal when all you need to commit that crime is one person. You know, but the moment you need more than one person to commit a crime, you need two people, three people, four people, it becomes much more difficult, much more complex, and it discourages the crime in the first place, right? So let me give you a few examples. I already mentioned one of them, which is that for every request, there needs to be an approver. So if you're going to ask for money, you can't just do it alone. Somebody has to approve. So that automatically means that you need a minimum of two people before that money goes out. If you're going to purchase a major piece of equipment that requires a lot of money, for example, I expect that the higher the amount of money you're asking for, the more approvals you need. So maybe if you just need $10 to buy paper for the printer, right? The team leader or whoever is most senior in the office should be able to approve that, right? And then all of a sudden you need $100 because you need to buy raw materials. Okay, you need the signature of the supervisor. You need the signature of the manager, right? Then you need to buy something for $10,000. Then that means that sort of thing will come to your table. So the higher the amount of money you need to pull out of the business, the more levels of approvals you need. And by the time you introduce more approvals, it means you need more people. So the higher the amount of money, the more people you need to approve it. That means it's going to make it much more difficult for crime to happen. Because if you want to withdraw, if what you need from the business is $10, you need two people, you know, the requester and the approver. If you need $100, then you need three people to approve. If you need $1,000 or $10,000, then you need four people, you know. So like I said, it's harder for people to commit crime because if more people are involved, and that's what segregated responsibility means. One other way this can show up is, for example, the person who keeps the check, the checkbook of the company, the person who writes the check should be different from the person who reviews the check and signs the check. So if you are the person signing the check, you shouldn't be holding the check. So that way, for any fraud to happen, you need the person who holds the check and the person who signs the check. So you need two people. That way, it is more difficult to commit the crime. Another way too is the person who pays in the money into the account should be different from the person who does the bank reconciliation. I'm going to talk a bit more about bank reconciliations later in this episode, but I hope you get the gist. The gist is that you need to segregate responsibilities. It shouldn't be easy for one person to do everything, because if one person does it, then crimes are easier that way. Now, the seventh practical type of controls I want to talk about are budgets. And budgets are a fascinating type and very effective type of control in any business, because when you have a budget, what it means is that you have created a guidance for people who spend in the business. For example, in the month of July, this is how much we spend on raw materials, on utilities and stuff like that. So it limits waste and it discourages theft, because you have capped how much money can be spent. And the moment people spend above budget, then it draws attention. And the last thing a criminal wants is to draw attention to themselves. So by introducing a budget, you limit the amount of possible fraud or waste that can happen in your business. And this is usually very effective with expenses. So if you have a good understanding of how much your business typically spends on things like utilities, like internet access or electricity or water or diesel, right? Things like that. For example, if you run a factory and you run generators, right, and you buy diesel, that is one possible source where somebody can want to defraud the business, either by underreporting the amount of diesel that was supplied or inflating the prices. But if you already know how much you typically spend on diesel and you put it right in the budget, what it means is that if anybody tries to steal from the business, they have to be very mindful of what is in the budget, because if it goes above budget, it's going to raise a red flag and it's going to draw attention. And like I said, criminals don't like attention. So the reason why a budget is cool is that you set a bar, and then anybody or any amount of money that goes above that bar has to be justified and will draw your attention. So that's why budgets are really very, very powerful. Another type of practical control I want to talk about are reconciliations and audits, right? So the good thing about controls is that they are a system of checks and balances. You check one side and you also check the other side to see if it balances. So one good example would be your bank account, where you receive inflows from customers, payments for your goods and services. So all this time you've been receiving money in your bank account through checks. People have paid with their credit or debit card at your location, at your office, at your shop. You know, people have been doing bank transfers. People have been wiring money across from their bank to your bank. People have been paying with mobile money. So you have all this money flowing into your account, right? But there needs to be a side where you reconcile those amounts. You actually ask your bank, or these days you can do it via online banking. You pull out your bank statement for the month. let's say for the month of August, right? You pull out your statement for the month of August and you're reconciling all the, you're reconciling the amounts with the amounts in your sales ledger. So this month you sold 1,000 units of your product, right? What that means is that if you've accepted payment for all those 1,000 pieces in your bank account, we should be able to see the payment for those 1,000 pieces. And that's exactly what a bank reconciliation is. A bank reconciliation is checking that all the money we're expecting in the account is actually in the account, and all the money we spent from the account actually left the account. That way, if somebody has been playing tricks, for example, they said they paid in a check, but they never paid in the check, or maybe there's some sort of fraud going on, your bank reconciliations are going to help you find out. And that's why in most well-structured companies, they do bank reconciliations every month. And even in businesses that have a high level of activity, maybe retail outlets and stuff like that, they do bank reconciliations every week. Some really big businesses that get volume do bank reconciliations every day. So it depends on the volume of activity in your business. But I hope you now understand why bank reconciliations are important. They are a balance. They are a system of checks and balances to be sure that the money you expect to be in your account is actually in the account, and the payments you made from your account actually left. Sometimes checks never clear. Somebody pays in a check, it doesn't clear. Sometimes people try to do transfers and it doesn't go through. It bounces and they tell you they've made that payment, right? So by the time you do your reconciliation, you'll be able to find out who is owing you and who you're owing. Another good example of reconciliations and audits is a stock count. So if, for example, you have a business where you sell products, so you have inventory in your store, you have stock in your warehouse, right? Sometimes a common way that theft can happen in a business is on your records, you have on your records that you have 10,000 pieces of your product in the warehouse. But at the warehouse, they're stealing from you. Your guys are stealing from you. Some of the boxes inside your warehouse are actually empty. They are stealing your products at the warehouse and they are selling it on the black market. So what a stock count does is you carry out periodic audits at the warehouse. You show up at the warehouse and you do a random count. You just choose one product item on your list. You go to it. You ask the storekeeper, show me this item. You count them to be sure that the number that's physically present in the store matches what you have on your records, right? Because sometimes the business has records, but those records do not reflect the reality on the ground because people are stealing stuff on the shop floor. So your stock counts help you make sure that what you have on your records are actually what you have in your store. And sometimes a stock count can happen every quarter. It can happen once a year. It can happen once a month. It all depends on the volume of stock you have, the level of activity in your store, and then the complexity of your business. Of course, the more people you have, the more employees you have in your store, the more likely it is that people are stealing stuff. So the more stock counts you do, the easier it is for you to catch on. Because if somebody is stealing something, if you find out that what you have on your records is not matching what is in the warehouse, immediately that triggers an alarm. You know, somebody is doing something here. Then you can start your investigations to find out exactly where things have gone wrong and why some of your items are not available in the store. So these are just some examples of reconciliations and audits that help to make sure that sometimes you might be very solid on your record keeping. You're keeping very good records. But because you're not treating it as a system of checks and balances, your records say one thing, but then the reality on the ground inside your warehouse says something else. So a reconciliation can actually help you solve this kind of problem. The other kind of control I want to talk about, number 9, concerns company-controlled information, company-controlled contact information. Now, just imagine this scenario. You hire a couple of salespeople. They are going out. They are talking to your customers. They already know your customers. This is very common in some mid-sized businesses, right? So these guys are talking to your customers, and then all of a sudden, you fire one or two people, or one or two people resign from the job. But guess what? Most of your customers already have their telephone numbers and their email addresses, their private email addresses. So that's one easy way for them to steal your customers, right? So what a right-thinking business would do would be that if you are in such a situation, all your employees should have an official company email. It should be a matter of policy that when your employees speak to suppliers, distributors, customers, anybody, they do so from their official company email. And some businesses also have official numbers for their employees. Sometimes you look at a company's website, the number that's there is the company at the office. They don't put the private cell numbers of their employees because employees can leave you. And when they leave you, when your customers call them, you know, anything can happen from there on. But if they have the official number, even if your employees leave or anything changes, the email address they have is on your official company domain. The phone numbers they have is your company phone number, right? So that way there is business continuity. You don't suffer setbacks because somebody has, some of your customers are now contacting some of your former employees, right? So I had a personal experience with this. One of our partners is in a South African company. They're one of our media partners, right? So whenever they have advertisements or sponsorships, they typically push it through us. So one day, I think that was 3 or 4 years ago, my contact person at that firm in South Africa reached out to me to say, you know, she's now with a new firm and she was essentially trying to solicit me, right? But one thing I noticed was the owner of the company had this this company email she was always reaching out to us on, right? So what I did was I forwarded that email I received from the ex-employee to the owner of the company to say, this is what I'm getting from this person. Now, imagine if I didn't have the official company email. What it meant was that I didn't have any way to report what was going on, because essentially that person was trying to steal the company's customer. So that's why it's important. Even social media handles, you need to have official social media handles. When your people are posting stuff about the company, they shouldn't do it from their private email, from their private social media handles, or from their private email addresses. They should do it on the official handles. And that's why it's very important that you have all these things as a matter of policy clearly defined, so that people do not make these mistakes. So I hope you get that. You need to control the contacts centrally. Have company email addresses, have official phone numbers, and have your official social media handles on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and all that. And any communication should go through the official channels. The reason why that is important is that if you allow your people to use their private platforms, the day they leave your business, they are going to leave with all that information, and that is not good for you. The 10th type of practical control I want to talk about is to make sure you have a direct line for feedback. So it's all nice when you have all these systems and your systems are working. You don't always need to be at the office for things to happen. You know, you have different levels of, you have different spending limits. You have your budgets. Everything is running like a system, right? Now, the downside to that is that you do not have a lot of visibility on what is happening down the line. And that can be a serious weakness. So to solve that problem, you need to have a direct line for feedback. You need to give yourself a channel to get direct feedback from your customers, your distributors, your suppliers, and even the general public, right? Very, very important. If you have a website, the official address on that website should be such that if anybody sends an email to that website, you should get a copy. There are some things that you need to have insights on. If, for example, you have an inquiry email, right, or a complaints email where customers can complain, right, you need to have a copy of that email. And these days with technology, it's very easy. You can have one receiver email such that any email that comes to that email address, you get a copy in your own email. So that way, you don't have your staff filtering out negative messages and only telling you what you want to hear. Because if you don't have a direct line for feedback, what you start to hear will be your employees will start to tell you what you want to hear. They will only tell you the good stuff, but you will never learn of the bad stuff. And that's because they will not willingly want to tell you bad stuff, that they are not doing a good job. Everybody wants to present themselves in the best possible light. So if you want to get the real feedback, make sure you have a direct line, you know. So that's very important. And then the 11th practical control I want to talk about is key metrics, right? This is a very important piece of control you need to make sure, keep your eye on in any kind of business you run, right? So your key metrics are, for example, are key ratios that can show you when there are early signs of trouble. So one clear example would be things like your profitability ratios, like your gross profit margin. Your gross profit margin is the difference between what it costs you to produce or purchase a good, that you're selling, or what it costs to deliver a service. That's the first level of profit. Most times, it's supposed to remain the same, except the cost of your raw materials are changing, or somebody is changing the sales price of your products or your services. So if you know what your margins typically look like, let's say, for example, your gross margins are usually between 38% to 40%. All of a sudden, you're noticing that your gross margin has dropped to 33% or 30%. Something is going wrong, and you need to investigate. Is somebody inflating the cost of your raw materials so that they can steal money that way, right? Is somebody maybe selling your product at a lower price and then taking the difference, So you need to investigate. And that is why that key metric is important, because the moment you see that your gross margin, which is typically between 38 to 40%, has gone really low, then you know that there's something going on there. And that means you have to investigate further. Another two will be the operating margins, right? So operating margins is what you get when you remove the cost of your overheads from your gross profit. So things like salary, rent, your utilities, things like that, advertising, all of that. So if you remove those costs, then you get your operating cost, your operating profit margin. So imagine that your operating profit margin is typically between 15 and 17%. That's your operating profit margin for at least the last 6 months. All of a sudden, you're seeing that it has dropped to 10%. What is going on here? That would be the question in your head. What is going on here? Is somebody inflating prices? Is somebody paying more than they should and is stealing money through that means? That will become a red flag, and that will force you to investigate further. Another kind of key metric would be your budgeted numbers versus your actual numbers. Now, the thing with budgets is this: most times you budget. A budget is just a guide, right? It's just what we think we're going to spend or make in this month or this quarter. Sometimes you spend above budget. Sometimes you spend below budget. Typically, for a business, what you want is to be spending below budget, as long as your budgets have been solidly done. But when your budgets are above for your expenses, you're spending more than you budgeted, you need to look at that, because clearly something is going wrong. If on the basis of your historical information, your historical data, you have planned for your business, and it's on the basis of that planning that you got your budgeted numbers, how come the actual numbers, the actual amount of money that was spent, is more than what you budgeted? What is going on here? Is it that your budgeting was poor, or is it that somebody's actually inflating figures and fleecing your business and stealing from your business, right? So that's one way to look at it. Look at your budgeted numbers versus your actual numbers. Another thing to look out for will be to look at the month-to-month or year-on-year divergences, right? Some businesses are cyclical. So maybe during the summer, maybe every summer, the volume of sales drop, or maybe every summer, the volume of sales rise. That may be the kind of business that you're in, right? Or maybe during the holidays, during November, December, January, your sales rise, or maybe your sales drop. Some businesses have those patterns. So what it means is that if I compare January of this year with January of last year, the performance should be roughly, similar somehow for some kinds of businesses. Or if I compare this month to last month, I should have an average expectation based on the way my costs are rising or my sales figures are rising. So when you compare numbers, they start to tell you things about your business. And then if you notice that you compare a certain month to another month and it's looking, way out of alignment, then that's a sign that something could be going on there. So what I've just explained to you in this episode are intelligent and creative ways you can actually investigate in your business when it is necessary. What some people do is they start to act as some unsanctioned police. You're monitoring everything that's happening in your business. All of a sudden, your employees are feeling like you don't trust them. You don't think that they are responsible enough. You don't think that they can do the job. You don't trust anybody. And if you build a culture of mistrust in your business, what you give is what you get. Your employees would end up not trusting you. After all, you don't trust anybody. But what controls do is that You only step in when there is a reason to question that something is going wrong. That's why these controls are very important. You don't question everything. If things are going according to plan, the spending is in line with the budget, your ratios are holding up, your metrics are holding up, your bank reconciliations are not flagging anything, there's no reason to be bothered, right? But if all these things start to flag something, then you have a reason to be concerned, and then you go dig. But guess what the good part is? When you react on the basis of your controls, it's likely that when there is a warning sign and you dig in, you will find something. You will either find that somebody has been trying to steal your business, so has been trying to steal money from your business, has been stealing in small amounts, or maybe something has changed. Maybe the prices of raw materials in the market has changed, or maybe something, you know. So you're going to find something, definitely, which is much better than always suspecting everybody and hoping you find something. This is not Sherlock Holmes, right? You have a business to run here. So let's recap. In this episode, I talked about why it's important we talk about controls, intelligent ways to reduce or avoid theft or fraud in your business. And then I talked about the fear of letting go. Some entrepreneurs are locked up in their business. What they have is a job, not a business. Because any day they don't show up, nothing happens. And that is a clear sign that they do not have the right systems and controls in place. Another is stunted growth. Without a system of controls, it's almost impossible to scale or grow any business because you can't be in two places at once. So if you're going to open in another city, another town, another country, the only way you can be sure that you're not being fleeced, that nobody's taking advantage of you or stealing from you, is to have the right controls in place. And then I said it's not sustainable. It's not sustainable to be a police person in your business. There is a joy to entrepreneurship, and part of it is not suspecting everybody and just walking around and hoping you find something. And then I talked about controls. I said controls are, they include processes. Some of the things I've explained to you here are processes. Some of them are procedures, and some of them are safeguards that are meant to protect your business. And essentially, I said controls are, in summary, are there to protect you from three kinds of bad things. Three kinds of bad things. Controls protect you from bad people who want to steal your business, take advantage of you, or destroy all your years of hard work, right? Controls are there to protect you from bad actions. Even if you have good employees, good people can take bad actions. They can make mistakes. They can be guilty of errors, right? If you have the right controls in place, it will check those kinds of bad actions. And there are bad decisions. You might have good people, talented people, skilled people, but they can make bad decisions. All it takes sometimes to crash a business is one bad decision. For example, you are trying to pay somebody $10,000 and the person makes the mistake of writing an extra zero. That's an extra $90,000 you're losing just because of one small mistake, one zero, right? But then because you have the right checks in place, that can actually help you get through these sorts of situations. So then I also talked about specific examples. I mentioned 11 intelligent and creative controls you can implement in your business starting right now that can help you become a more efficient business owner. So the first one was reduce liquid cash. Cash is the source of temptation in most businesses. If you reduce the amount of cash, you reduce the temptation. The second is spending limits. The third, approvals. The fourth is to segregate your key accounts. The fifth is formal requests. Requests should be formal to avoid, I thought you said, she said, he said. Then I talked about segregated responsibility. I talked about budgets. I talked about reconciliations and audits. I talked about company-controlled contact information. I talked about having a direct line for feedback. And then I talked about your key metrics. So at this point in the episode, let's talk about our partners, Quezza. Quezza is doing an astonishing thing for entrepreneurs on the African continent, especially if you trade in goods that have potential on foreign markets. So we're seeing situations where people produce shea butter or honey, or they produce this beautiful artwork or clothing, right? But then within your local market, you may not be getting the right prices for these things. But imagine if you could export those products to the US or to Canada or the UK or to France. That's exactly what Quezza is doing. Quezza has opened the door to international trade for small and mid-sized businesses across the African continent to sell products beyond their countries. We're seeing people sending products from Nigeria to South Africa. We're seeing people sending products from Kenya to Cote d'Ivoire. We're seeing people exporting products from Ghana, Nigeria, South Africa to markets in the US, in Canada, in the UK, in France. So imagine what this could spell for your business. You need to go check it out. Queza is K-U-U-E-Z-A. Queza, K-U-U-E-Z-A. So if you're a seller, if you have a business and you're trying to explore export markets, you head over to the App Store if you're using an Apple device, or the Play Store, yeah, whichever one you're using, Android or Apple, and search for Queza Seller. So if you're a seller, search for Queza Seller. And if you're looking for interesting things to source on the African market, if you're in Nigeria, Ghana, or any of the African countries, or even in the diaspora, and you're looking for exciting African products to buy, you need to download the app from the App Store. And of course, search for Queza User. There are two different apps for sellers and for users. So it depends on whichever you are. Search for Queza Seller or Queza User. At this point in the episode, there are four things I need you to consider. Today's episode came up as a result of a session I had with one of our insiders. Our insiders is a community of entrepreneurs who are building businesses in over 20 countries within and outside the African continent. So essentially, what we have are ambitious people, visionary people who are trying to build their business. And the thing about entrepreneurship is you get to eat problems for breakfast. There are simple decisions that can make or break your business. If you don't get the right guidance at that point, right? There is no one course, there's no one book that will answer all the questions you have about the problems and challenges and opportunities you're seeing in your business. But belonging to a tight network, a closed network of entrepreneurs who are on the same line as you are, some of them are more experienced than you are, some of them are less experienced, they work in very different markets. We learn together, we network, we collaborate, we do all sorts of things together. And it's one of the unique opportunities you have to work directly with me as you build and grow your business. So to check out the insiders, check us out at smallstarter.com/insiders. Again, it is smallstarter.com/insiders. The second thing I need you to do is to tell your friends about this podcast. The quality of information you're getting here is very practical, proven, and effective. And you can start to implement it in your business today. This is not theory. This is practical stuff. So if you have a friend who's struggling with their business, either they're trying to start a business or they already have a business that is struggling and they need to turn it around, tell them about the Small Starter Business Podcast. They go on Google, they search for Small Starter Business Podcast, and boom, we're right there. And guess what? There are over 60 episodes to listen to. They cover everything from sales to market entry to how to raise capital for your business, how to assess business ideas, how to start, strategy, talent, all sorts of things, operations, right? So tell your friends about the Small Starter Business Podcast. If you're trying to say, if you like the quality of information we offer here, that would be a nice way to say thank you. And of course, another way to say thank you is to leave us a 5-star review. If you like what we do and you want to give us a pat on the back, head over to smallstarter.com/review and give us a 5-star review. It will be nice for my ego, but the better thing is that it's going to let the algorithms know that this is a podcast that people need to listen to, and it's going to recommend it to other people, right? So again, consider joining the Insiders program. If you're looking forward to a one-on-one arrangement, or you want to belong to a community of entrepreneurs who are thinking in the same direction about exploiting opportunity, translating their dreams and ideas into real businesses, right? You need to check out the Insiders, and we are at smallstarter.com/insiders. Until the very next episode, there is no problem that cannot be solved, right? So don't worry about your problems. Worry about your skills. Because if you have the right skills, problems are nothing. And that's exactly what entrepreneurship is about. Entrepreneurship is about developing your skills so that you get better at problem solving. And the better you are at problem solving, the easier it is for you to get people to pay you. Because people pay people to solve problems. That's what entrepreneurship is about. So don't blame the problems. Don't complain about the problems. Don't feel frustrated about the problems. Be concerned that you don't have the right skills. Because if you have the right skills, guess what? It's no longer a problem. So until the very next episode, I'll talk to you. Stay safe. Look after yourself and yours. And I'll talk to you in the very next episode. Cheers. Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Small Starter Business Podcast. To take our free business courses or join one of our signature programs for special entrepreneurs like you, head over to smallstarter.com to join our private community. See you inside.